Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to Madison's Notes, the official podcast of Princeton University's James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. I'm your host, Annika Nordquist. Today, we're going to be chatting about Marie de Vignereau, a 17th century French aristocrat, the niece and heir of Cardinal Richelieu, who played an extremely important role in French history and yet has been largely forgotten. Here to discuss is Bronwyn McShay, the author of the first ever biography of Marie de Vignereau, La Duchesse, which we're going to discuss today. She earned her bachelor's and her master's in theology at Harvard and her PhD at Yale. She was a fellow here at the Madison Program from 2018 to 2020. And she's also the author of Apostles of Empire and, very, very recently, Women of the Church. So with no further ado, I hope you enjoy this discussion. Bronwyn, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you on.
Thanks, Annika. It's great to be here.
So to kick us off here, you've written this lengthy biography about this French woman, Marie de Vignereau, who none of us have ever heard of. Mm-hmm. Why does it matter that people know who she is?
Well, as I try to demonstrate in the book, she was one of the most influential, powerful, and I think interesting women of the 17th century, and one of the more interesting figures in that whole century. She was very important to French history in an era famous for the rise of absolutism and other important historical developments. And she sort of got written out of the French story in the 19th and 20th centuries. And yeah, she was just an astonishingly important, interesting person who belongs in historical narratives of her time.
Let's kind of start with what are the big things that she did that were really impactful, and then what was taken out later? How was it possible to edit her out?
Sure. Well, the big things that she accomplished, different stages of her life. She was the niece of the Cardinal Duke de Richelieu, who's the prime minister of France under King Louis XIII. And he's one of the most significant figures in French history. And she was basically his right hand for a number of years. She kind of represented him to other people when he wasn't at court. Mm-hmm. People came to her looking for favors from Cardinal Richelieu. So she sort of fulfilled this unofficial role as one of the gatekeepers of the Richelieu administration. And that's when she was young. As she sort of came into her own, she became a major literary patroness, artistic patroness of important figures like Pierre Corneille, one of the great playwrights of the 17th century. And then once Richelieu had passed away and given her a tremendous fortune, one of the largest fortunes in all of Europe, she it's not too much to say that she kind of directed the buildup of the French church and charitable institutions and its kind of global reach in the 17th century at a time when the French Catholics were establishing missions in various continents around the world, both in connection with colonialism and not in connection with colonialism. So she had kind of a global reach to her accomplishments in a way that's rather intriguing and unusual to see for a lay figure, let alone a lay woman who is not a monarch, who's not kind of one of the princes of Europe. So among other things, so which we can get into some more details.
Yeah. Let's start with, I'm going to start by talking about what happened when Richelieu was alive and then after he died. But let's first take a step back. Some of us have not had the pleasure of learning about Richelieu since AP European History.
Sure. Uh-huh.
And so let's kind of take a step back. Why does it matter so much that Marie de Vignereau was so helpful or influential on Richelieu? What was kind of his role within France?
Well, several things. I mean, he developed a very high idea of the French monarchical state, that politics was about advancing the interests of the French state with the king as kind of the representative of the French people and French interests. And he did various things with regard to the tax system, with regard to disciplining noble families that encouraged the creation of what begins to really look like the modern French state. Mm-hmm. And Louis XIV, the Sun King, finished a lot of the projects in this vein that Richelieu began. He also kind of helped develop a stronger sense of, people are not speaking of French nationhood yet. That's kind of an 18th century and later idea, but a strong sense of French identity, to use a modern phrase that they wouldn't have used, associating it with excellent literature, excellent certain artistic styles, architectural styles, sort of glory of French arms, but also culture. So not just kind of a military victories and things like that, but it's kind of an idea that there's a common French culture emerging, and that this is part of what the French can give to the world. So things that I think we associate with the rise of modern France are partly being pursued consciously by Richelieu as the king's own right-hand man, but chief advisor, kind of basically ruling the country behind closed doors on behalf of the king. So I come at this from a French history background, so it's kind of established in my mind how important Richelieu is. So presenting like why he's important, say, to Americans in the 21st century is another question. I try to explain some of this in the book and get into that, but that's at least a start.
Of course. Well, so then I guess then the sort of obvious follow-up is, so how was Marie helping? Well, I guess, take one step further back than that. How does it come to be the case that Marie is, especially, as you say, as a lay woman, is doing so much to help her uncle in his designs in France? And what are kind of some of the tangible impacts that she has?
Right. So two quick points of context. This was a day when the courts of the kings, the queens, certain high-ranking dukes, and some of the informal patronage relationships between the sort of great figures, people working in different roles in their courts, really affected political decisions, because it's hard to describe it. I kind of describe the world as it's happening, as it takes place, but personal networks, patronage networks were very central to the development of political schemes and military schemes and cultural schemes by government officials and members of the French monarchy, royal family, and aristocracy in general. So, and then early on in Richelieu's career, King Louis XIII was very young, and his mother, the queen, was kind of the ruler of France. This is Marie de Medici. She was the regent. And so the women's court was actually quite a crucial power center. There was a separate court for the queen and her entourage, and a lot of the power politics were happening at the queen's court while her son was young. There is a... his niece... So his niece was his widowed brother-in-law's child. His sister had died young, and he kind of raised Marie from her late teen years forward. Like he was her main protector. He became kind of a father figure. Now he was a cardinal of the church. He's a bishop before that, but he enters into this highly political role, the kind of leading advisor of the king, and he does not have a wife. He doesn't have a daughter. And having a very close, trusted female family member who could sort of have a high position at the queen's court was a real sort of anchor into the life of the royal family. And so he kind of, I don't want to use the word scheme because it develops over time. She sort of learns how to serve the interests of his projects, the Richelieu family, and projects she cares about, initially in the role of one of the leading ladies-in-waiting to the queen mother. Now, I had, before going into this project, I had kind of a, I don't know, like a an old, like, I used to read a lot of historical fiction when I was younger. And, you know, I liked, when I was a young girl, I liked stories of princesses and courts. And I always thought of being a lady-in-waiting not in a very political way. But it could be a highly politically important role. And so, anyway, that's kind of going into a lot of detail there, but
no, please talk more about that.
Yeah, I think so that's how she was able to become important to him politically, was right. partly through this relationship to the Queen Mother, and then to several other powerful women in French political life. And then she essentially, I mean, they would not have used this phrase. Over time, as he becomes more powerful, partly with her assistance, like in this courtly role, she serves what looks a little bit like the role of a lady, a first lady. I mean, there's not a prime minister position in the modern sense, like a kind of constitutional role for a prime minister, the way it developed in the English state. So he's the leading minister of the king, but he's in actuality, he's serving the role of something like a prime minister and representing the king in various contexts of French political life. And so she is essentially serving a function similar to a first lady. To that role, which is a politically important role in certain times and places. So I think that's at least a start.
I love the observation that you make about how most of us don't think of being a lady in waiting as very political. Mm-hmm. You associate it with like dresses and shoes and that kind of thing. But it's also kind of funny because in the book, you do point out that learning how to dress appropriately and all that kind of stuff was something very important that Marie learned at court. Is that kind of stuff political in this French context? And how can a lady in waiting be a political role?
Right. I think, so if you're the queen mother and you're essentially the regent of the country, or you are the, as the king comes of age, the queen still has a tremendous amount of influence on her son. And they have a kind of volatile relationship.
Right.
He's annoyed at his overbearing mother. And they eventually have this dramatic moment where she's pushed out of political life, and Richelieu helps with this, and Marie is very glad because that she and the Queen Mother over time do not necessarily get along very well. But early on, she's asked to, when you're helping dress the Queen, or in Marie's case, she was mistress of the garde-robe, the wardrobe of the Queen. So she's guarding all her jewels, her hats, her cloaks, her dresses. That doesn't sound that important, but that she had access to. Many times she was in control of who had keys to the queen's bedchambers and private spaces. And she and several other women, and they're very competitive, the noble families, as to who gets these roles, because you're with the queen, who in some cases is the leader of the country, in her most intimate private moments when she's being herself and, you know, telling stories about growing up as a Medici or complaining about her husband, how he treated her. Like, you're learning kind of some of the secrets of the royal family. You're with them a lot. And so it can be a very highly political role when politics is run by these personalities, right? So, and it's very coveted. And so positions in the royal households, Richelieu began to fund the salaries of some of these women at the court and also other royal officials. This was one way that you gained influence at court, was to actually help the royal family pay the salaries of various officials in the royal household. And so some of the nobles with influence would try to compete over how many and which particular people close to the king or queen or other members of the royal family were loyal to them. So getting Richelieu loyalists into the court was a very important political project. And Marie helped with that. She would help vet which women were trustworthy, which would sort of serve interests of Richelieu and herself and other people, as well as be loyal to the state. So, so anyway.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, and I think the other thing that strikes me is a little bit unconventional about the story, like sort of the early life portion, at least from the way that we think now, is usually you think of someone, okay, I've raised this person as my daughter, so now you're sort of a mentor to her, you're helping her, and instead it's very much a two-way, they kind of help each other in court, and in fact, despite being kind of the junior of the partnership, she becomes very indispensable to him. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that develops over time.
Yeah.
Because initially, understandably, and this would have been true a century or two later, too, in a courtly context, Richelieu's main hope, partly, one of his main hopes in positioning his niece in this very central role was that she would marry someone very high ranking, possibly even the king's brother. Gaston, the Duke d'Orléans, and that was, he always, there was a denial that that was a project he was engaged in. We don't have necessarily hard evidence that, that's what he was doing, but marriages, I mean, aristocratic women, one of their primary functions, obviously, right, in this society, which was patriarchal, despite having very powerful women like Marie emerge, is that who they marry and who their children are key to their right, role. He did have her marry very young. She was 16, before he was very powerful at all. While he was still rising to power, he helped arrange her marriage to a nobleman she barely knew. Mm. I don't want to give away too much of the book, but she ends up becoming a widow. I won't say when exactly, and so she's a young, wealthy widow when she is put in the position, right, of the second highest ranking lady in waiting at court. And so he hoped she would then have another great marriage, potentially to a very powerful prince. Mm. But she resists this, and she starts serving this role of helping him and representing him kind of just naturally by just being, she was very intelligent. She kind of followed his, she was interested in various things he was up to. And it took him a while, I think, to recognize this. Mm. There's one letter I refer to in the book. I forget how old she was exactly, but she's already been serving this role a little bit. And she overhears some serious political gossip that makes her feel like one of the projects he is trying to ensure happens at court goes forward. And she basically conveys through his top secretary this political gossip that she's heard.
Mm.
And he responds to his secretary, women should stay out of these political matters. And at this point, she has already like proven her role, her value to him. And so to see him kind of backtrack, but then it's not long after this that he raises her up instead of her brother. She had a brother who I think he wanted to serve this, a much more major role than he did, and to inherit his dukedom and all that. Her brother kind of was not very intelligent, was a spendthrift. He just he was not trustworthy. So Richelieu over time develops this relationship with her a bit begrudgingly because she's not fulfilling the functions that she's supposed to. But then he kind of dramatically decides, okay, that doesn't matter. We're going to do this a different way than is conventional. And I'm going to leave most of the power to her instead of her brother and wealth and all that. So I think by the time he's close to his death, he really understands how valuable she is and treats her a bit more like an equal. So that's some of the story there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of interesting because, I mean, I think sort of from a feminist standpoint, you're like, wow, that's sort of a lot of personal agency for a woman at the time.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, she's a super, super religious figure, which is something that you dwell on a lot in the book. Even kind of at this young age, are those, you know, that kind of female agency going outside the bounds of her kind of what her traditional role would have been, refusing, well, I'm sort of spoiling the book,
that's
refusing
okay,
to get married.
we'll try.
To get married.
Yeah.
Does that kind of come into conflict from a faith perspective?
I'm not sure I'd put it in those terms. So this is a time, so the French royal family is Catholic.
Right.
There's a bit more tolerance of certain high-ranking Protestant nobles in the era of Richelieu than you might imagine. France has recovered from the wars of religion. Protestants are allowed to hold certain positions in government at this point, but there's still some Catholic-Protestant conflict going on in parts of the country. So the most of the leading families are, at least in name, very devoutly Catholic. But at the very same time, there was a renewal going on after the Catholic Counter-Reformation that was affecting Catholic women, many of them at court. And they're becoming very kind of more focused on, they were called les dévotes, the devout women. They would get engaged more hands-on in charitable service. They engaged in kind of more rigorous prayer routines. And there was a bit of a split, like some of the more worldly women at court and men at court kind of made fun of sometimes these devout figures. And Marie, who becomes a duchess, she's kind of very associated with these devout women early on. But she kind of straddles both of these worlds. And so there's a lot of, there are various women kind of taking on unconventional roles, affecting social, trying to affect social reform and various things in the country. And so she is, I'm sort of losing my thread here. She wanted to be a nun at one point, then is not becoming a nun. And her, I think her faith in some ways gave her, inspired her independent spirit, because she's already part of a group that's kind of breaking some of the norms socially. I think it was certainly much more normal to for a lay woman to get married, and to she faced a lot of gossip, the fact that she did not remarry, and this was a struggle for her in some ways. So yeah, I think she's both drawing a lot of her independence from her very strong devout faith, but it's also coming into conflict with certain people's ideas of what a devout Catholic laywoman in this position should be like. So
I'm happy that you discussed it that way, because I think there's kind of two different ways of looking at the plot line here, so to speak. I mean, I think there's sort of the feminist version that she didn't get married, don't need no man. She created a role for herself where there wasn't one already. She was super, super engaged outside of traditionally female spheres. And then there's a version that, well, she started off so religious. She really wanted to become a nun. She wasn't really interested in marriage. She really wanted to pursue a religious vocation that was sort of separate from the ways of this world, and instead was essentially forced at gunpoint to join court and learn all everything about dresses and scheming and all the rest of this. And that it's sort of a downfall of a person who otherwise might have been kind of separate from effete French society. So among kind of those two ways of looking at her story, is there some way to harmonize them, or is there one that's more true than the other?
Yeah, I mean, I try to just present the facts as I see them, and I think she evolves over time. I was working against kind of maybe a way that I would answer this. There were some 19th century narratives about her. So I said she was written out of history, but she was partly, her legacy kind of got dampened because the one other biography of her written before mine, published in 1879, was by a pious Catholic aristocrat who saw her importance, and he wanted people to know about this great woman in French history. But he, partly based on evidence and scare quotes that I could not find anywhere in the archives. I think he may have made up some things, like a papal bull. I don't know. I mean, forgive me if he's up there listening, if it just got lost. But I think in the 19th century, for a Catholic aristocrat, there are actually in some ways stronger, more narrow possibilities for a devout laywoman in his mind. And I think he was more troubled by the idea of a long-term widow who does not become a nun when she's free to, than even in the 17th century that she and some of her friends would have been. And so he interpreted her life as kind of the fruit of a frustrated Carmelite religious vocation. And she certainly was drawn to the Carmelites and drew a lot of sustenance from Carmelite spirituality after spending a lot of time as a young woman with nuns at a convent in Paris, and being mentored by an older nun who she believed should be considered a saint. But as I started with that narrative, and as a good historian is supposed to not necessarily assume that it's true. And so I was looking for data on both sides of that. And I just was struck that the story that I see is someone who is very intense in her religious devotion privately. At one point really wanted to become a nun, but she kind of accepted maybe the role of divine providence, we might describe it. Like her uncle asked her to play this role. She didn't necessarily want to do this. It took her several years to acclimatize to this, and she starts to be good at it, and she starts to enjoy the position she has, and she starts to love fine dresses and jewels. And she not only likes dinner parties, she becomes one of the great hostesses in Paris at a time when this is kind of a new thing for aristocrats outside the court to be hosting grand events. And so she starts to kind of realize things about herself in this more worldly role. But that fundamental sense of devotion, I think, really helped her refine what kinds of people she wanted to promote through this worldly environment and what kind of projects she believed in and what kind of men she refused to marry who presented themselves to her. Or so it affected a range of her decisions within this world. And so I think she was trying to maintain kind of an integration of these two things and would be the first to admit that maybe she sometimes failed at that. But I think that was her hope most of her life. So, yeah.
And so one more question about Richelieu before we kind of move on to after he dies. But I think one thing that kind of struck me about it is that they seem like they're pretty different people. That Marie is, I mean, for one thing, quite a bit more devout than him. She sort of came across a little bit more sensitive and hesitant. And so I guess, you know, overall, when you look at their relationship, I mean, given that it seems like his sort of natural political chops were so much stronger than hers. You know, how do they develop kind of that close relationship? Would you say that it was that their strengths kind of reinforced each other's?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question. I sometimes, a question like that, I'm so like, sometimes I, you know, when you're deep in the details of a book,
you can
almost miss the forest that you've created for the trees that you've put together in the forest in the book. I think, she did have good political instincts. I think she very much was her uncle's protege and her like she was very good at cultivating political networks and private networks that served interests that both she and her uncle believed in. Like she actually helped him build up his network in some ways, which was very critical to how he became powerful and maintained power and was able to kind of push out various enemies, perceived enemies from what he was doing. But in terms of, he was devout in his own way. I mean, the irony is that he is a churchman.
Right.
He's a priest and a bishop and then a cardinal. But he was a bit more comfortable with kind of worldly enjoyments. He was less sort of troubled. She had a more, her conscience, I think, was more pricked when it came to, you know, indulging in great dinner parties a lot, or sort of she had an ascetic sensibility. Like she had a, I think he saw that almost in a, it's kind of odd to see it in one letter I found that he wrote to her. He almost seems to have this modern, something like a modern aversion to kind of ascetic discipline or kind of a self-punishing mode that is coming partly out of the monastic tradition that she's drawn to. And so there's some tension there. He wanted her to just kind of enjoy the world a bit more than she did. I think she comes to do that. I'm not sure I'm getting at your question now, because
I
think their relationship is so, the part of the problem, it was so personal and private. And many of the sources I looked at show, like, you have known times when they were together. They probably were conversing, but we do not have records, transcripts of these private conversations. He very quickly saw her as one of the few people he could truly trust. And he did not trust many people. He was, he was so focused on his political agenda to the point that most people found him very cold and calculating. Sort of the famous image of Richelieu is this cold, calculating, almost bloodless, political mastermind, But he in front of his niece, he actually suffered from depression, it seems. He cried a lot. Like, she saw a side of him that was very, very human. They shared enjoyments. And so I think they had a true family bond that was quite strong. And so I think they worked out these differences the way you do with any close family member. You kind of learn to kind of play off each other and live with some of the differences or different points of view. They were so close, in fact, that some people speculated there was some sort of unholy relationship going on there. So, and the gossip mill in that era was terrible. I mean, there are, like, you know, the tabloids in the supermarket, like, I have nothing to on what people were publishing about powerful people back then. So anyway, I'm not sure if I answered the question.
No, that was very kind of amazing also, because in history you don't always get like an image of people who are as close as that. And I think it's a good, I realized maybe I should have asked this closer to the beginning, but now is as good a time mm-hmm. as any. Like, the source material, mm-hmm. what was kind of the state of that? Because it seems like if she was mentioned in so, so many sources, mm-hmm. how would it be possible to kind of erase her from the story?
Yeah, that's the irony. I think once I should clarify for people listening. So typically, I mean, this is a bit of a caricature of the more complicated reality, but typically when you're looking at an early modern female figure in history,
right,
the kinds of sources you have to rely on are private letters, journals if they survive, if they were literate, and more kind of private materials of a more personal nature. And when you find those treasure troves, it's amazing because it's rare to have. Not that much of her personal correspondence survived. Mm. I had bits and pieces, or I had the other person's letter to her that survived, or her letters to someone else who saved her letters. She destroyed a lot of her correspondence before she died. So there are big gaps in kind of what she herself could have told us in historical records. And at first I thought that I would not be able to write this book. But I then started, I had this hunch. I mean, I follow my hunches sometimes. I started seeing her referred to in footnotes in books on all sorts of topics, like the history of missions, the history of charitable projects in Paris, the history of like playwrights. And like she starts to appear in footnotes and sometimes archival sources. And so I just started building up a kind of a database of the kinds of sources. I then start looking for her. Once I realized she was more important than I thought, and then even her first biographer indicated in his footnotes and some of what he writes about her, I started looking for references to her in the memoirs of important figures or the correspondence of people, say, like Cardinal Mazarin, Richelieu's successor as prime minister. And what I began to find, like in the political correspondence of Mazarin, like shocked me. Like her importance is very clear to you know, the successor of Richelieu as prime minister. And I just started to, once I started looking, it was almost everywhere. It was like hiding in plain sight. But I had to kind of gather it all from various sources, different archives, different libraries, early print books. And it took a long time to build up the source base. But there are a lot of gaps in it. And so there are parts in the narrative where I can't really say what she was thinking I think it ends up being okay. Like I let the reader in on certain moments like that and just let them decide based on circumstantial evidence with me. So yeah, anyway.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, especially, I don't know, I can understand why it's so frustrating for historians to have her burn her letters, but I'm like, would I have done the same thing? Probably.
Who knows why she did it? I mean, I think part of it, my gut tells me some of it was secrets of her uncles and maybe her own she did not want posterity to know about. There is, I maybe won't go into this, but she did have a strong love interest in her life. And I suspect some of those were just she wanted to keep private. A frustrated love interest. So I think she was private. She didn't necessarily want certain details about her life left for her kind of, not all her relatives who inherited her money liked her. I don't think she wanted her relatives to find some of this material and do bad things with it. So
that is timeless. But it's also, I mean, a good transition because we sort of talk about after Richelieu's death when she begins kind of all these charitable projects. It's kind of amazing. I mean, you point to some really big names that everyone would know, Pascal, Descartes, where she had a really big impact on why they kind of were able to rise to prominence. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think I would qualify Descartes. I think she helped him. The evidence is not quite as strong as Pascal. She knew Blaise Pascal and his sisters when they were very young. She helped mentor them, and she helped Pascal's father was kind of kicked out of the French court for a while because he had gotten on the wrong side of the administration. And she kind of artfully finds a way to bring them back into the scene there. She, on the side of charitable projects, St. Vincent de Paul is one of the most important French Catholic saints of the 17th century. He started the Congregation of the Mission, priests devoted to serving the poor in rural parts of France. They are connected to the Daughters of Charity, this kind of innovative Institute for Women. And in older books on Vincent de Paul, he is depicted as this charismatic priest who kind of won over pious widows like the Duchess of Aguillon, Marie de Vigneron. And what I found is she kind of helped make Vincent de Paul. She was one of his most important patrons. There are a number of other leading Catholic clergymen at the time that she was their patron, not vice versa. Like she helped make the career of several important bishops, some of them in mission territory, some in France. The range of characters in the sense of a story that she helped make their careers or helped kind of guide them into projects that they became famous for historically is kind of amazing. So it sort of illustrates the importance of patronage in this time period and how a woman's patronage could do a tremendous amount, even if that woman could not serve in a political role per se, like in a governmental position, or of course she could not be a bishop, obviously, in the Catholic Church. But it illustrates also the power that certain lay figures had as well. Like we think of the bishops as somehow telling the lay people what to do, and in many ways it was the opposite in this period.
Right.
Sometimes pious networks of and not so pious networks of lay elites were kind of orchestrating what's happening with the church and various projects that are famous from church history in the time. So you just have to sort of look from a different angle and you start to see it.
So when you look at, I mean, some of these, given kind of how devout she was, Pascal makes perfect sense. There was also a female mathematician she helped.
Marie Crewe, yes.
Right, which is sort of less kind of central given sort of her religious interests.
Sure.
And then she's wading into, I mean, some plays that were pretty controversial at the time, which was kind of surprising to me because you sort of were like, well, maybe she's a little bit, you know, tightly wound when it comes to the religious element is maybe something you would assume. And yet some of these plays were kind of subverting expectations about the way that plots would unfold in plays, sort of unusual for the time. Is there something that kind of particular interests that sort of bind together what she chooses to be a patroness of?
Yeah, I think, well, so an example of one of these plays is Pierre Corneille, Le Cid, the story of the Spanish folk hero, medieval folk hero, El Cid. It was controversial at the Académie Française, which her uncle founded, gatekeepers of excellent French literature and language. And she helped Voltaire in the 18th century, actually credits Marie de Vignerot for making the career of Pierre Corneille. So Voltaire knew she was important, but then it's sort of forgotten in the next century. But one of the things, this is not necessarily a kind of point of principle binding everything together, but some of the projects she's supporting, the way some of the controversial plays and poetry and other things were a little bit fashionable, some of these styles at the Spanish court. Some of the spirituality that she favored, the Carmelite spirituality, was coming partly out of the Spanish scene. She had some Spanish influences on her from some of the nuns that mentored her, and also Marie de Medici was... she's a Medici and a Habsburg and is tied to the court of Spain. And so there's a bit of, there are cultural currents happening that she just enjoys, and they're partly coming from similar influences on her life. And she just seemed to have this, whether it's, you know, a book promoting greater ideas of the equality of men and women, their capability, which is kind of radical to see her promote books like that.
Right.
One of them written by a monk, actually. So there were religious figures promoting kind of more what we might describe as radical ideas for the time that she's patronizing, or whether she's promoting a charitable project that's strongly driven by a kind of deeply Christian sense of seeing Christ in other people and living more like Christ in the world. I don't think she saw these things as in conflict the way some people in her time did. So, I don't know. There's an independent ability for, she had this independent spirit, an ability to kind of weave these things together in a way that made sense to her without, she didn't like sort of conventional boxes, I guess. And yet, at the same time, she promotes very conventional modes of life for some of her young nieces and nephews. Mm. Like she has a conservative instinct in terms of what she promotes among other young women. Like she doesn't think all young women should not get married like she did.
Right.
And so she has a lot of tensions, I guess. And I think my job as a biographer is not to actually tie all these things together, but just to present who she was as the sources show us. And so I sometimes get a little uncomfortable with questions like, how do I sum her up? Because that's
right.
in a way that's I'm going a little bit beyond my ken there,
right.
beyond my role.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting also, you know, you sort of refer to the very beginning of this interview mm-hmm. to the global impact.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's kind of amazing because it's right at the outset of when it was even possible to have a global impact,
mm-hmm.
which is
yeah.
easy to forget that, mm-hmm. I mean, 100 years previously, that wasn't a thing. You need mm-hmm. like a European impact.
Yeah.
But I think it's also something that today people look back on and have mixed feelings
sure,
about
mm-hmm.
And probably would not describe the typical kind of French colonial project as mm-hmm. Community service, which is definitely the
yes.
way that Marie thinks about it.
Right, right.
So can you talk a little bit about her involvement in the New World?
Yeah, so I want to actually, if I quickly sketch out. So she was very tied. So the French were getting involved in the colonization of parts of North America. So New
right.
France, they were beginning to appear in the Caribbean. They were, they had some aspirations to colonial ventures elsewhere, including like the island of Madagascar off of Southern Africa. But they also had diplomatic and trade relationships with places in Southeast Asia,
right.
in North Africa. And she has projects in basically every location where the French are expanding
wow.
either commercially or colonially, which are not always the same thing in this period. So the French are kind of latecomers to building a colonial empire. And
it's a lot of places, though.
I mean, it's a lot. And,
she
actually had some ties to some of the merchant companies. I dutifully looked to see if she made any profits from the slave trade. I couldn't find anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that she did not. So I like to kind of be forthright about that because obviously it's an issue people care about a lot. But the French, everywhere the French send colonists or merchants or fur traders, they are also sending missionaries in North America. It was initially the Jesuits primarily. And the Jesuits kind of recognize some of the Native American populations with whom the French are building trading relationships primarily were suffering from epidemics of smallpox and the
right.
like that had come up from Latin America. The French did not have the modern science. They did not know that all this disease was coming from the earlier European waves in Latin America. So when they arrived in North America, there was an assumption that these populations were just very poor and sick and dealing with a lot of problems. And so that there was an initial concern to build some hospitals, to build institutions that would actually assist some of the native populations that the French are engaged in pretty friendly trading relationships with primarily.
Right.
And she sponsors the first charitable hospital, and it's devoted to Native Americans, not to the French population, in Quebec, the first charitable hospital north of Spanish America. And she also establishes similar charitable hospitals in North Africa and several other locations. But she's also involved with other charitable projects in mission settings that are either tied to the French colonialism or tied to French diplomatic or merchant ventures. So I guess that sort of summarizes it quickly.
Is there a reason why she had such an affinity with the Jesuits specifically? Because they would have been a pretty young order at the time,
Yeah,
right?
Well, they've been around actually since the 1540s.
Okay.
She had I think the affinity at the beginning was simply that they were the most engaged in mission work
right.
in the 1630s when she starts to kind of become interested in global projects.
This
is before Richelieu dies. So she actually... The Jesuits actually liked other orders to get involved where they could. And so she sponsors Augustinian women. Some of the first female missionaries in history go and join Augustinian canonesses, the hospital sisters. They go to Quebec. Over time, though, she doesn't work that much with Jesuits. I think St. Vincent de Paul and his Congregation of the Mission, the Daughters of Charity. She was a lady of charity involved with laywomen, involved with charitable service. Mm. She promoted their projects. She actually helped build up secular clergy, secular meaning diocesan clergy who are under the authority of, direct authority of a bishop. So they're parish priests, not priests from religious orders. She helped set up some missionary dioceses in Southeast Asia and one in North America. And so she actually builds up the secular clergy in mission settings. And she's one of the major founding figures of a French Foreign Mission Society that is still active in Paris today, that trains parish clergy for mission work or charitable work in different global settings. So she actually worked with a wide variety of orders and kinds of clergy and kinds of religious and also lay people. So what's really striking about her, there's an affinity with the Jesuits because it's just like inevitable if you're interested in missions in this period, but also she diversified her resources. Mm. And I think she had almost an investor's way of looking at the spiritual life and charitable projects. She liked to diversify in case some of these things fail. So then you have different kinds of things going on that promote French interests, Catholic interests, and so on in different ways.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, so to kind of close us out here, so I was just in France a few weeks ago, and one of the, I mean, I'm a grumpy ancient history person who's not at all interested in any sites that kind of, you know, had to do with the French Revolution.
Sure, sure.
And yet you really cannot avoid it.
Yes.
It's everywhere because like every church you go to, if it's medieval, if you go to, you know, great houses, all of this stuff, there's immediately a story, what happened to this during the revolution, so much was destroyed, et cetera, et cetera. And so I guess kind of from that angle, when you look overall at Marie's life, to me, you're like, wow, there's so much kind of going on here, and yet it's so close to just the total fall, the total destruction. And so I guess knowing as we do know how the story ends, are there kind of seeds that you see of that in the way that the French court worked that you see in Marie's life?
Seeds of the French Revolution coming?
Yeah, if we know how it ends and knowing how it ends, when we look at the story, do we have clues?
I think I would caution us, because I'm a historian, she died more than 100 years before the French Revolution. So she died in 1675. There are some tensions. I mean, the centralizing power of the monarchical state is happening. Noble families are getting... there's the Fronde Civil War that happens.
Right.
And she's involved.
Right.
She's a strong supporter of the monarchical state versus some of the princely families that feel like they're getting squeezed out by this kind of new bureaucratic kind of mode of governing. The Richelieu family, I mean, Richelieu's idea of the central state, he often tried to represent the interests of sort of the common people.
Right.
So there was a some sense that more ordinary French people should be kind of brought more into the functioning of French civil life, and that the princely families sort of had too much kind of independent control. So there are historians who work on this trajectory and can show you much more clearly and in a much more articulate way than I can certain things that are happening in her period that are part of the trajectory that brings us toward mid-18th century crisis that starts developing. But you really don't see it. It's really not there. And what struck me is just how complex and almost like an unknown country her world is. Like when you focus on a figure, and there are lots of things I assumed about her time period that doing this project made me question. And so I think where the revolution really comes in, though, is not sort of what you can see in her time predicting what might happen later, but it helps explain why she was forgotten.
Right.
So one key thing, the Richelieu family had several great palaces that actually the royal family envied. And one of them, the Chateau de Roy, west of Paris, was envied by Louis XIV. He tried to buy it from her and she said no. And she was one of the only people who could say no to Louis XIV and get away with it. That palace was destroyed after the French Revolution. It was brick by brick was sold to people who wanted to use the materials for other building projects. So there were these kind of impoverished noble families that were connected to some of these properties, and their palaces were destroyed just to gain some, you know, some money in the new era, right? And there are some, the Carmelite convent where she was, over time it got demolished after several different revolutions in France, and the sort of old regime structures that she was attached to just got sort of literally buried by history. And so you don't see, there's no physical memory of certain places that were very important to her. Mm. One of the few that exists is the Petit Luxembourg, a mansion in Paris,
right,
where the president of the French Senate resides and has his offices today. And it's very, you can't, so, and people know that there's some connection to Napoleon at that building,
right,
but the plaque on the outside of this building doesn't mention her as one of its famous former residents. Hmm. And I somehow was able to arrange a private visit to this building, thanks to a friend who knows a French senator, and to actually be in her home. And part of it is the structure that she lived in. The rooms are the same size and, you know, with updated furniture, obviously. And it's just striking that her main home is still right there in the center of Paris in a leading kind of tourist spot, but there's no plaque indicating anything about her. So the revolution and a lot of different changes that happened in France since her time are partly to blame for why she's kind of invisible to many French people today. So.
Wow. Well, yeah. That is a great note to end on.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Brahman. This has been really fun.
Thank you so much.
Well, there you have it, Madisonians, Bronwyn McShay on her book, La Duchesse, The Life of Marie de Vignerot, Cardinal Richelieu's Forgotten Heiress Who Shaped the Fate of France. The book is linked in the show notes, so you should absolutely check it out, as is Bronwyn's most recent book, Women of the Church. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find out more about the James Madison Program and everything that we do here on Princeton's campus at jmp.princeton.edu. There, you can learn about our initiatives, sign up for our mailing list, see all the upcoming events that we're hosting here on Princeton's campus, and also find the recordings of all of the previous events that we've hosted over the last several years. You can also find us on social media, on Twitter at Madison Program, as well as on Instagram and Facebook. And last, but certainly not least, please do consider giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. We really appreciate it, or leaving us a review. Again, thank you so much for tuning in, and I can't wait to see you next week here on Madison's Notes.